All right, hello everybody, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, 5 p.m. It's a great time to be, great time of the week, isn't it? 5 p.m. on a Friday, happy hour all over the place. I'm hoping that you're happy right now
it's
as you're
tuned
in. It's
a super happy hour.
Absolutely. Glad you could all be tuned in. We are, of course, continuing our Friday edition of American Hit Radio, which we call How Music Changed, and we have been for 54 shows now, taking an in-depth look at the career of the Beatles, playing all of their official releases in chronological order, along with their history, of course, and various bits of information as they arrive and as they're relevant to that time that we're covering, playing every track that was officially released by the band, including live tracks, radio tracks, demos that had come out, the official stuff, I should say, like the anthology series, not focusing on demos at all. But by doing so, we are now up to show number 54, rather incredibly. We're right in the middle of the White Album. It took us a number of shows to get from the last studio album to the White Album. Excuse me.
Well, that's because you spent some time doing the solo stuff of John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
Yes, we did.
You tortured your audience.
With at least one show, I did torture the audience. I apologize for that. Hope it was at least informative. And, of course, there was so many bits and pieces of sessions that were leading up to the White Album that eventually were released. So we covered a lot of that. Well, last week we did our first show dedicated exclusively to the White Album. We got up to about two-thirds of the way through side two of the album, so we can pick up exactly where we left off then right now with this track, Pie Paul, a little strange short little ditty called Why Don't We Do It in the Road.
Why don't we do it in the road?
The shorter songs, and one of the stranger songs released by the Beatles. That song's pretty indicative of why there was a significant number of complaints about the White Album when it was released. A lot of people were saying that there was material on it that was subpar for the Beatles, that it wasn't particularly focused. It didn't, I mean, especially, I guess, supposedly coming on the heels of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was a well-polished masterpiece. And all of a sudden, you've got this really rough-hewn album, which has got, you know, all the rough edges are showing, and Paul singing really by himself, no one of the Beatles even involved on that track, singing a song called Why Don't We Do It in the Road, and it sounds like it's like a one-off idea, really like a bad, dirty joke, really.
Yeah,
you
right.
know. So there was a significant amount of complaints about it. I mean, what's funny about it is over time, the White Album has become by far the best-selling Beatles album of all time. It's going to like 20 times like multi-platinum or triple platinum or whatever that means, 20 times triple platinum. But I mean, it's their best-selling album in their catalog. Most people say that it's their favorite Beatles album. Not necessarily, but I mean, it's always up there. It's the album that a lot of people would recommend, myself included, if you were going to be trying to turn people on to the band and have them get into the whole diversity of what they're about, because there's a lot of changes. But it at the time, with the complaints going on, Paul McCartney, like I'm paraphrasing here, but I remember his quote was like, "Listen, it's the bloody Beatles White album, and it's great, and it sells. Shut up." And it's pretty succinct. And he was, you know, ultimately Paul was right, because it did sell, and it still does sell. So, and what you end up with is a tremendous amount of diversity. Like, after a song like that, with Paul getting pretty much as lewd as you're ever going to hear him get.
Right.
You know, because the man had so many facets. He had, you know, there was also the guy who wrote what Lennon would call granny music, you know,
right.
and the gentle love songs. The very next song on the album was one of his ballads called I Will. I'm going to read an excerpt from the session for recording this on September 16th, because a few interesting things happened. George was not involved in this recording session for Paul's ballad I Will. The other three Beatles taped 67 takes of
Whoa.
The song. So even that sort of like begs the question, like, if it's such a casual album where they really weren't, you know, the material wasn't up to snuff, they're doing 67 takes. That to me shows,
well, they just couldn't turn it off.
Well, it's just them doing the song 67 times. And, you know, and finding their correct take in there. Anyway, Paul singing and playing acoustic guitar. Ringo plays maraca and cymbals. And John is just tapping out a beat with wood on metal. Paul, so while they were recording the song, Paul also slipped in several ad-lib numbers between takes, one of which was eventually snipped in to the White Album. There's this little untitled ditty on side four, just before you go into Revolution 9, where he starts singing, "Can you take me back where I came from? Can you take me back?" That was just Paul making up this little tiny piece of music. At the time, it lasted 2 minutes and 21 seconds, and they cut out a 28-second section, which was dropped in between Cry Baby Cry and Revolution 9. It also became a bit of a clue in the Paul is Dead thing, because all of a sudden, in the middle, you have Paul singing, "Can you take me back where I came from?" It sounded so mysterious and dark, like, oh, it sounds like they did that on purpose. But there it is. Also, at the same session, there was a little piece of talking at the beginning of Revolution 9, which was also recorded this very same day. Alistair Taylor, the office manager at Apple, came into the studio with a bottle of wine, and he saw George Martin, and he was begging his forgiveness for not bringing him a bottle of claret. And if you listen very closely to the mumbling at the beginning, before he starts going, "Number nine, number nine," what you hear is Alistair Taylor on this date, September 16th, apologizing for not bringing the claret to George Martin. And then the song begins. Keep that in mind when we get up to that track, which will probably be next week when we finish the album. Anyway, let's get to Paul's next song on side two of the White Album. Here is I Will.
Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I will. For if I ever saw you, I didn't catch your name. But it never really mattered.
Two tracks were eventually culled to be used on the White Album, and it was on October 13th. It was actually a Sunday, which was very rare for the Beatles to have a Sunday recording session. But that was it was on Sunday, October 13th in 1968, when John Lennon went in by himself to record what would be the absolute last song to go down for the album. This is actually, again, an excerpt from the Beatles Chronicle for that date. A delivery deadline bearing down upon them, this was the Beatles' first Sunday session since recording Hey Bulldog back on February 11th, and it saw John start and complete the album's 32nd and final song, his touching ballad, Julia. He taped it alone. It is the only solo Lennon recording in the entire Beatles canon. He sung twice along to his acoustic guitar accompaniment to double the vocal, and we left with a very simple, affecting song written by John. Again, like alluding to his mother, but not necessarily specifically about her, but maybe about the emotions that are brought about by her memory. Here's the song. It's called Julia.
Half of what I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia. Julia, Julia, ocean child calls me. So I sing the song of love, Julia. Seashell eyes, windy smile calls me. So I sing the song of love, Julia. Her hair of floating sky is shimmering, glimmering in the sun. Julia, Julia, morning moon, touch me. So I sing the song of love, only speak my mind, Julia. Julia, sleeping sand, silent cloud, touch me. So I sing a song of love, song of love for Julia, Julia, Julia.
Apparently the woman responsible for John naming his first child Julian, as Heidi just pointed out, it never even occurred to me. It's fairly obvious though, isn't it? Simple observance. Very good, Heidi. Now that we are at exactly the half point of the album, it's probably a good time to talk about the record itself and the record sleeve. At the time, it was weird to see the white album when it came out. Not just the fact that, of course, it was a plain white cover looking like it could have been a bootleg album.
Right.
Because there weren't that many bootlegs around at that time, and the ones that were around generally were just plain white covers with somebody's name printed on it a little bit sideways, you know, not done too well. And that was what was amazing about this, is the original album had the word The Beatles embossed in the cover,
right?
Not written. So unless you could actually see how it was raised, there was nothing on the cover at all. It was just a plain white cover that, you know, if you turned it to the light.
I wonder if they did that because they had to whitewash the building for Apple.
Actually, they just did it because they wanted. Well, I'll tell you what. Here's a story. I could Paul McCartney can tell you all about it right now. This is a quote from Paul. A nice thing about the album was the cover. I had a lot of friends in the art business, and with Sgt. Pepper, I had been involved with Robert Fraser. I knew a lot of artists through him, and one of his people at the time was Richard Hamilton. I'd been to a couple of exhibitions, and I liked Richard's work, so I rung him up and said, "We've got a new album coming out. Would you be interested in doing the cover?" He said he would, so I asked everyone. They said yes, and then they let me get on with it, really. I used to go out to his house in Highgate and chat about it, and one day he said, "Okay, get lots of snapshots, go back to all your baby photos, get photos of yourselves any kind, and I'll make a collage." It was very exciting for me because I'm into art, and I could be his assistant for the week. Liaising, however you say that word, liaison.
Liaising.
Yeah, thank you. Between the guys, getting the photographs and having them copied. Then I just sat around for the week watching him put the collage together. It's lovely just watching someone paint. The great thing at the end of it was that when he'd filled the whole collage with photos, his final move was to take pieces of white paper and place them strategically to give space through the whole thing so that it wasn't just crammed with pictures.
Hmm.
He explained that this was so the whole picture could breathe. You could see through the density, which was a great idea and gave me my education about negative space, which is apparently what it is called. I think I would have just left it as it was because it looked great anyway. But if you look at that poster now, the white areas are very clever. This was, of course, not the cover for the album, but the poster that was included with the album. Because if you had bought the white album, there was this fold-out, very big. I mean, in the CD, it's infinitely smaller. Well, it's at least, it's about maybe one-tenth of the size. When originally it was about 24 by 36. Yeah, it's about, it was six panels, 12 by 12. Or thereabouts.
Huh.
Anyway, getting on to the rest of the cover. Then in the end, he said, "Well, what are we going to do for the cover now that we've got the poster? What's the album called?" And he asked, "Have you ever had an album called The Beatles?" I said no and had to check back, though, because I wasn't sure. It had always been Beatles for Sale, Meet the Beatles, With the Beatles. There had always been something similar, but never just The Beatles. So Richard said that was what we should call it, and everyone agreed. Richard was very minimalist, and that's obvious.
Duh.
And he wanted to have a completely white cover and emboss the word Beatles on it. At that time, he had a friend who always smudged things, like a bit of chocolate or whatever. So Richard wanted to put an apple smudge on a bit of paper. That proved hard to do. So we said, look, let's just leave it at the white cover. Then he had the idea to number each album, which I thought was brilliant for collectors. You'd have, you know, triples, or, you know, 50 number one, 50 number two, three, and so on. If you got, for example, 000200, then that would be an early copy. It was a great idea for sales. EMI weren't easy to persuade, and they said they couldn't do it. I said, look, if a millimeter can turn over, you must be able to do that with every record that goes out. And they found a way. I think they stopped at some point, so not all white albums have the numbers on them. But it was a good idea, and we got the first four. John, I think, got the first one. He shouted loudest.
He always does.
But actually, maybe it's the next quote. I got number one because I'm lovely. John was actually the kindest and most loving overall when he could be, and he wasn't quite as cynical as everyone expects. I got number one here and number four in America. So that was the other thing then, besides the word Beatles being embossed without any color in the beginning. I mean, subsequent printings, as you can see on the CD version, it's printed in gray. But at that time, it wasn't any color at all. It was just plain white with the emboss on there. And then you'd see somewhere else the numbers that they were talking about, the catalog numbers. I've got an original copy of myself at home, which actually has the catalog number.
Thank God it doesn't have some special thing on the cover of it, because I'm sure I would have ruined it a long time ago.
So anyway, that's the basic story there. Between the poster, the simple cover, they added those four, which are now iconic shots of the Beatles in these really big 8x10 glossy photos, which is a really classy thing to do, because I remember you felt as though
they were like family shots because they were really good, clear photos. They were high quality photo paper when they first came out. Subsequent versions, again, reduced them to plain paper printing. But at the time, in the beginning, they were photo quality paper and they were genuine, like photo prints. So it was very cool. Meanwhile, that brings us to side three. We can start with the first track that appears on side three of the album. Here's the Beatles. Oh, wait, I got to get out the other CD, don't I? I forgot it's a double album, isn't it?
That's right.
So let's cue
this thing
up.
Good thing you remembered now.
The first Beatles album to come out, by the way, with the Beatles album, I should say, that to come out with the Apple label, which was fairly cool.
Oh, this one you mean?
Yeah. The way it would work. On side one, you get the whole apple. Side two, you get the apple sliced in half. That's the way it worked. Okay, then I think we're ready. Then here we go with side three. Here's Birthday. Quite the rocker. Probably the most straightforward rocker on the album. And it is a great song. It still sounds great. It was simple.
Well, I just love it because it's always my birthday.
I think that's one of those songs that I expected to age quickly because it's such a simple number. But it hasn't. And a relatively interesting story about how that came about, the recording of that song. So, I'll read an excerpt again from the Chronicle on September 18th. Regarding this track, although this day's EMI session was logged on the recording sheet as having started at 5 p.m. and finished at 5 a.m., there was nonetheless a clear break in the middle for all four Beatles, Yoko Ono, Patty Harrison, and Chris Thomas, and probably others too, left the studio to pop around to the corner to Paul's house to watch the classic rock and roll film The Girl Can't Help It, which was on the BBC that night from about 9 till 11. Earlier, the first to arrive for the session, Paul had concocted a new song right there in Studio 2, developing a catchy riff into a full-blown rock number called Birthday, sort of inspired by watching Little Richard and the other rock and roll numbers in The Girl Can't Help It. Then the others arrived, and by 8:30 they'd recorded 24-track takes, completing the backing track. Returning to the studio around 11 p.m., energized after watching Eddie Cochran, Little Richard, Gene Vincent, Fats Domino, and other heroes, Birthday was finished off with a 4-track to 8-track copy and a host of overdubs onto this: tambourine, piano, hand claps, backing vocals, helped out by Yoko and Patty, and Paul's lead vocal with occasional contributions from John. The complete recording was mixed into mono that morning from 4:30 to 5 a.m. Once again, of course, Yoko being in the studio. Now, we talked about this a little bit last week. Got a few more quotes from the Beatles regarding that instance, which we may as well bring up since you just heard Yoko singing with Patty Harrison in the background on that track. Paul McCartney first up. Now John had to have Yoko there. I can't blame him. They were intensely in love in the first throes of the first passions, but it was fairly off-putting having her sitting on one of the amps. You wanted to say, excuse me, love, can I turn the volume up? We were always wondering how to say, could you get off my amp without interfering with their relationship? It was a very difficult time. I felt that when John finally left the group, he did it to clear the decks for his relationship. Anything prior to that meant the decks weren't clear. He had all his Beatle baggage, all his having to relate to us. He just wanted to go off into the corner and look into Yoko's eyes for hours, saying to each other, it's going to be all right. It was pretty freaky when we were trying to make a track. Looking at it now, you can be amused by it, and it was quite a laugh, really. But at the time, this was us, and it was our careers. We were the Beatles, after all, and here was this girl. It was like we were her courtiers, and it was very embarrassing. The White Album was a very tense one to make. George Harrison. Tends to be a bit blunter, actually, George. Maybe now, if you talk to Yoko, she may say she likes the Beatles or that she liked the Beatles. But she didn't really like us because she saw the Beatles as something that was between her and John. The vibe I picked up was that she was a wedge that was trying to drive itself deeper and deeper between him and us, and it actually happened. It may be unfair to blame Yoko totally for any breakup because we'd all had enough by then anyway. We were all going our own ways, and she might have become the catalyst for speeding up that situation, whatever it was. I don't really regret any of that, but at the time I was definitely uncomfortable about her being there. Last word to John. If it is Yoko and Linda's fault for breaking up the Beatles, they can have the credit for all the great music that each of us made individually. Linda and Yoko never had an argument, ever. How can two women split up four strong men? It's impossible. Looking back, I understand there had been four guys very close together, and the women that were there with them, wives or girlfriends, had been the old-fashioned type of female that we all know and love, the one that was in the kitchen the whole time with the baby. She never came to the sessions even. You never saw the wives, only for openings and when they did their hair. And suddenly, we were together all the time, in a corner mumbling and giggling, and there were Paul, George, and Ringo saying, what the hell are they doing? What's happened to him? And my attention completely went off them. Now, it wasn't deliberate. It was just I was so involved and intrigued with what we were doing. And then we'd look around and see that we weren't being approved. But I understand how they felt, because if it had been George or Paul or Ringo that had fallen in love with somebody and got totally involved, then he trails off. I always preferred it to all the other albums, including Pepper, because I thought the music was better. The Pepper myth is bigger, but the music on the White Album is far superior. I wrote a lot of good stuff on that. I like all the stuff I did, and the other stuff as well. I like the whole album. I haven't heard it in a long time, but I know there's a lot of good songs on it. Here's one of John's straightforward blues numbers that he wrote. Recorded mostly live in the studio, the Beatles did a lot of jamming on this album, and some of it ended up making the cut, including this song called Your Blues.
You know the reason why. breaks my eye. The worm, he licks my bone. Feels so suicidal, just like Dylan. Girl, you know the reason why. Black cloud crossed my mind. Blue mist round my soul. Feel so suicidal. Even hang my rock and roll. Wanna die. Yeah, wanna die. If I ain't dead already. Woo! Girl, you know the reason why.
Two songs that showed not only the variety. A lot of people would say that that is a good example of the difference between Paul and John, where John would be singing "Your Blues," "I'm Lonely," "I Want to Die," and Paul is singing his, you know, this really pretty song about Mother Nature's son. But it was never really that simple. It was never really that simple. In fact, never even that simple, even on this side of this album, where, you know, we just heard John singing "Julia" a few moments ago,
right?
And Paul is the one who was responsible for writing "Helter Skelter," which was considered really one of the most violent or violent-inducing songs that the Beatles had ever composed. So it never quite as easy as it seemed. Or as simple as it seems.
Right.
Now, the sessions, the reason it took us so long, by the way, as you probably recall, with the shows leading up to the White Album, is that the Beatles' recording sessions went on endlessly to put these tracks down. In fact, the next song on the album goes all the way back to early June. So they're recording from June right on up until October. If you think about, you know, the early days, the Beatles were putting an album together in a few days. Even Sgt. Pepper was done really in a matter of about 2 months. So for them to be spreading out their time over almost 6 months to put out a record was mind-boggling, especially an album where they weren't, where it wasn't like they were trying to deal with perfecting the arrangements and coming up with new rich ideas of orchestration and things like that. They were just trying to realize their songs.
Right.
But their personal lives were getting in the way in so many different ways, which is another big part of what we were covering with all that, with John with his own private interests and George with his own interests and everything else that was happening with Apple. Things became very confusing. But anyway, this song goes all the way back to the very beginning of the sessions for this album, one of the first songs that were completed and pretty much sitting in the can waiting for the rest of the album to be finished around it. Still one of my favorite songs on the album. Great rocker. Everybody's got something to hide except me and my monkey.
You made a fool of everyone. day. The world was waiting for the lover. She came along to turn on everyone. Sexy Sadie, the greatest of them all. Sexy Sadie.
Another early song from the Sessions, that one inspired directly from John's trip to see the Maharishi in India, which started out for John as a wonderful experience, but then he was jarred when he was convinced about that a rumor was true about the Maharishi making sexual advances towards somebody in the party. And John believed it and immediately started writing this song about the event. It has since more or less been discredited. In fact, it was even said that somebody like the guy Magic Alex, who was responsible for so many wacky situations and tried to convince the Beatles to buy an island, et cetera, did a lot of the electronics work for Apple that ended up throwing immense amounts of money away on some loony ideas. They said that he had started the rumor to see if, as a way of trying to get the Beatles out of India, and it worked. Now, I don't know if that's a stone-cold fact, but I know that it was some people were crediting it to the fact that Magic Alex started the rumor and that it was essentially unfounded. But he had John's ear because he was John's friend. That being said, let's get up to the stories for the next track. Now, the next track was, as I said, the Beatles were at this point in time doing an awful lot of jamming in the studio. One of the first things that they actually did jam on was Revolution. And the first version, the slower version, which appears on side four of the Beatles or the White Album, the slower version kicks off side four. That started out as a jam that went on for the better part of a half hour.
Whoa.
And the initial song itself was edited from the beginning, and the extra bits at the end where the singing started to get crazy and with John moaning and some of the screaming, that's what they ended up editing out and using that for Revolution 9. So that's why Revolution 9 ended up really being an extension of Revolution 1.
Interesting.
Taking the number 9 simply because of that was dubbed in there as well with the number 9 and all that. But there's an awful lot of the music was provided by Revolution 1. But anyway, that being said, with the jam part, Paul decided that he would try writing a song in a similar method as what John was doing. And then Paul came in with his song, Helter Skelter. And we had a few weeks back, we did play an edited version of one of those jam sessions where the song would go on for upwards of a half an hour in some instances with the Beatles really sort of plotting their way through it. It was fairly boring hearing those really early versions. So it's incredible to think how the production and revisiting the song turned it into this incredibly gigantic wall of noise and just this monstrous heavy metal song before heavy metal existed. You understand? At this point in time, 1968, there really was not very much that sounded like that at the time. Here's a couple of quotes regarding the track and its aftermath. Paul McCartney speaking about the song at first, of course. I was in Scotland, and I read in Melody Maker that Pete Townsend had said, "We've just made the raunchiest, loudest, most ridiculous rock and roll record you've ever heard." I never actually found out what track it was that The Who had made, but that got me going, just hearing him talk about it. So I said to the guys, "I think we should do a song like that, something really wild." And I wrote Helter Skelter. You can hear the voices cracking. And we played it so long and so often that by the end of it, you can hear Ringo saying, "I've got blisters on my fingers." We just tried to get it louder. Can't we make the drums sound louder? That was really all I wanted to do, to make a very loud, raunchy rock and roll record with the Beatles. And I think it's a pretty good one. That's why I get annoyed when people say, "You just do the ballads, you're the soppy one." I say, "Have you checked? Have you listened?" Not that I like justifying myself, but there is the other side of me. There certainly is. Here's the track, Helter Skelter.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you, don't you want me to love you?
Look out!
I should point out now, this is a good time as any to do it, that I think I've made up my mind that my intention is going to be that I will be replaying the White Album in future shows when we finish the stereo version of the album. I'll dedicate two shows with very little talk of me playing the entire mono mix of the album for two reasons. The first one, because it is significantly different on many songs than the stereo mix. So that I think it would be very interesting. And in some ways, it deserves to be heard because, for example, the stereo version of Helter Skelter is drastically different than the mono version. In fact, the mono version is about a full minute and a half shorter. It does not have that return fade, for example. When it disappears in the mono version, it's gone. So that's one reason I want to play that, because it is, like I said, every official release, and it's significantly different, so that matters. The other reason I want to play it is that here in America, the mono version was never released until the Beatles mono box set came out.
Yeah,
the remastered mono box set. And the only way you could get that is if you bought the entire box, fairly expensive. And since it only had the albums that were released in mono, it wasn't a complete Beatles set. So there were albums that weren't in the box. So it ended up being an unusual item. So a lot of people didn't buy it, still don't know that. That mono mix, they never had a chance to hear it. So I'll do that. We'll get there. When we finish the stereo album next week, we'll do a bit of a reprise for the mono mixes. Anyway, I guess playing that song, it's almost impossible to not talk about the aftermath with what had happened with Manson and everything. And I'm going to let the Beatles do it in their own words. Again, basically taking it from the anthology book that collected all of their own quotes, starting with Paul regarding Helter Skelter. Then it got over to America, the land of interpretive people. And as a DJ later would interpret the fact that I had no shoes on the Abbey Road cover, Charles Manson interpreted that Helter Skelter was something to do with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I still don't know what all that stuff is. It's from the Bible, Revelations. I haven't read it, so I wouldn't know. But he interpreted the whole thing. That we were the Four Horsemen, Helter Skelter, the song, and arrived at having to go out and kill everyone. It was terrible. You can't associate yourself with a thing like that. Some guy in the States had done it, but I've no idea why. It was frightening because you don't write songs for those reasons. Maybe some heavy metal groups do nowadays, but we certainly never did. Bob Dylan thought that the line in I Want to Hold Your Hand was, I get high, I get high, I get high. So there had been some funny little misinterpretations. But they were all harmless and just a bit of a laugh. Jake Riviera, Elvis Costello's manager, thought that living is easy with eyes closed was living is easy with nice clothes.
I bet it is.
But after all those little interpretations, there was finally this horrific interpretation of it all. It all went wrong at that point, but it was nothing to do with us. What can you do? John, all that Manson stuff was built around George's song about pigs and Paul's song about an English fairground. It had nothing to do with anything, and least of all to do with me. He's barmy. He's like any other Beatle fan who reads mysticism into it. I mean, we used to have a laugh putting this, that, or the other in a lighthearted way. Some intellectual would read us, some symbolic youth generation wants it, but we also took seriously some parts of the role. But I don't know. What's Helter Skelter got to do with knifing somebody? Finally, Ringo. It was upsetting. I mean, I knew Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. And God, it was a rough time. It stopped everyone in their tracks. Because suddenly, all this violence came out in the midst of all this love and peace and psychedelia. It was pretty miserable, actually. And everyone got really insecure. Not just us. Not just the rockers. But everyone in L.A. felt... Oh, God, it could happen to anybody. Thank God they caught the bugger.
Really?
Anyway, totally insane. That happened, basically, obviously, on the heels of this album. Now, that was the second to last track on side three. There was one more track to go. And this is the song that's remaining is a George song called Long, Long, Long. If you know the song, it's probably one of the most sleepy sounding Beatles songs. It almost sounds like George is tired or bored. And considering the length of the session, I can kind of understand why. It really is one of the most long recording sessions I had ever heard of as far as going straight. It actually started at 2:30 in the afternoon on Monday, and it didn't end until Tuesday morning at 7 a.m.
Whoa.
What is that? Something like...
That's crazy.
Like 32 hours or so? 32, 33 hours? All of this was spent recording the basic track of George's song, Long, Long, Long. At this time, it was going to the title, It's Been a Long, Long, Long Time. Anyway, in what was now becoming a familiar pattern with George's songs, John was not present for the session, nor for any of the overdubs. So the lineup was acoustic guitar and vocal by George, organ by Paul, and drums by Ringo. The best take, take number 67, which was also the last take, also featured the sound of a vibrating wine bottle, perhaps one of those bottles of claret that were being brought in by Alistair Taylor, which rattled on top of a Leslie speaker cabinet when Paul's organ hit a certain note. To compound the sound, Ringo recorded an extra spurt of fast drumming for the exact same passage near the end of the song, which now you know what that strange noise is at the end of the song. It's nothing more than a vibrating wine bottle on top of a Leslie speaker. Here's Long, Long, Long.